Welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. Heading back into the training world on this week's ABCA podcast with Baseball Flow's Dr. Ishmael Gallo. Dr. Gallo is a former professional baseball player and current doctor of physical therapy. Dr. Gallo received his Bachelor of Science at Cal State Fullerton and Doctorate of Physical Therapy from Loma Linda University. Dr. Gallo has been an orthopedic physical resident in Orange, California for the last 13 years. Dr. Gallo is a renowned expert in the field of baseball and softball training, dedicated to empowering players, coaches, and parents to take charge of their training. Dr. Gallo created the Baseball Flows app, which includes therapeutic exercises and instructional videos, carefully selected to address the specific needs of players. Dr. Gallo also works with the general population in his practice, so has a unique perspective on training modalities for all age groups. Let's welcome Dr. Ishmael Gallo to the podcast. I can do like 5% of what is available. Luckily, Jim Richardson, our office, is really good on video editing. The stuff I do video editing for us is iMovie, and that's about it. I'm just, I don't know.
How old are you?
This part I'm good. I'm 49.
Oh, yeah, I'm 47. You're the same generation, man. Yeah. I think it's like we know enough to mess
enough
it up
to get by. Like, that's all, like, I think people overthink that part of it. Like, and I think that's why a lot of people don't start some of this stuff is because they get too intimidated by it. And you know, I've said it many times on this. If you're willing to invest any amount of time on YouTube, you can learn anything through YouTube. You can. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, it is. I think, yeah, you're right. And I think there's so much knowledge in our generation too, right? The 40-year-olds, they have so much knowledge of like trial and error and things that we tried, but it's the generational gap that sometimes people don't take the chance. Yeah. And then you get sometimes these 20-somethings that are still experiencing and trying to figure out what's going on. Yeah. That kind of
Gen X. I know I'm partial to Gen X, but we've had this conversation with friends of mine where, you know, all of us pretty much had to take care of ourselves, but had to take care of each other too. Like, I love our generation of people because I think we had to get along with each other because the parents really weren't around that much.
Yeah, that's so true, right? It's that we actually learned under fire, which was different.
Good and bad. There's good and bad.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know, at least for you, as me, because I don't know if you know my story, but I dropped out of high school.
Yeah.
And it's one of those where you go like, yeah, I could have used some help, right? I could have used a mentor. I could have used somebody who was like, hey, man, get your act together. And who knows? Maybe I still wouldn't listen.
You don't know that. Like, that's the thing with the life path is, like, who knows? Like, if that didn't happen to you, who knows? Like, you may not be doing what you're doing right now. Like, I don't think you can ever look back. I think people ruminate so much on the past that they just get in their own way sometimes instead of just understanding and trusting that I'm probably in a better situation right now. And I know I've had a pretty great life, and so I don't ever take that for granted. There are some people that have really hard situations out there that sometimes you can't get over, But I think for the most part, most people, when they get sidetracked, is they worry so much about the past instead of just understanding I'm where I'm supposed to be at.
Yeah, and I think that's where baseball comes in, right?
Yep.
Baseball is a big part of my life, and it's one of those where you don't. I mean, you strike out with 3-2, bases loaded, and there's another at bat coming up sometime. You know, whether it's the next game. So it's one of those where you're right. It's something that you take as like, hey, guess what? That was an experience. I failed big. I actually failed the biggest way you could ever fail in life, which is not graduating. When everybody else, all my friends were doing it. But it's one of those where you just go like, hey, guess what? Next at bat, you know, flush it. What did you learn from it? And then you're right. I think it's one of those where you go like, don't let it happen again. Prepare yourself.
Learn from it. And I think that's a hard thing too. And I'm not perfect on that. I make so many mistakes that – you know, the biggest thing is trying to learn from it and trying to make adjustments as you go. And I think that's what successful people do is they take those setbacks, they learn from them, they're able to adjust and move on. And that's just all part of the life's journey. All right, here, Dr. Ishmael Gallo, doctor of physical therapy, but founder of Baseball Flows, and it's at Flows Doc on Twitter. That's probably the best place to find you, isn't it, besides the website?
Yeah, I think I'm very active on Twitter. That's probably the easiest spot to DM me.
First time recording with a hat on, by the way. I just got off the road. I've been watching games for the last 3 weekends, so I just got back. I was in Greenville, North Carolina, watching the LeClaire Classic. Shout out to ECU and 21 years of Coach LeClaire Classic. He actually coached at East Carolina when I was coaching at JMU, so that goes way back for me. I actually passed away from ALS, so if anybody's out there, if you – have an opportunity to support ALS, please do that. My high school coach's wife, Sharon Merkel, actually passed away from ALS too, so it does affect the baseball community, but it affects all of us. But that's where I was at, and then I stopped by Duke and saw Duke and Akron, and then I'm hustled over here to the office to get on with you. And we've been trying to do this forever, so I'm glad we finally got connected.
Yeah, we've been missing each other here and there, right?
Yeah, and you know, for me with the scheduling part, there's always those different times of the year, but this is a great time to get back into the training side of things because we have a lot of college teams going, but high school teams are getting ready to start, and then the youth side is getting ready to start too, so this is a great time to do this.
Yeah, we've been busy. We've been busy onboarding teams, getting them ready for the season.
Yep. What did you learn from Ken Revisa?
Oh, Ken, I'll tell you this. Ken was interesting because Ken wasn't Ken before when I went to Fullerton. Does that make sense? He was Ken, but people didn't know about him. So obviously, I didn't know about him either. So it's one of those where Ken really took a liking to me because I was an ex-baseball player when I went there. So he asked me a lot of questions, and I didn't understand why he was asking it. You know, I just thought like, hey, guess what? I'm done with that. I got done playing like 2 years ago, and I was kind of just moving on, trying to find my life, trying to figure out what I was going to do. And Ken would just ask me about like, okay, what did you think about when you were at the plate? What did you think about when you were at shortstop? What did you think about when you made an error? What did you think about? And I was always just thinking like, man, he wants to know a lot about, in my head, trying to get in my head about how I felt. And then he showed me a lot about failure and how I dealt with it. But he also illuminated some of the things that I actually didn't do well when I was in pro ball, you know? And I think for me, I never really discussed that story with anybody, because I felt like it was so personal and I really didn't even understand why I was done with baseball at 25. So I think Ken was able to walk me through it a little bit. It was really a blessing.
He's probably trying to learn on the fly then too. I mean, that's a while ago before he really kind of got started on a lot of that stuff. He's probably still trying to feel his way through how to help players in the future.
Oh yeah, 100%. I think it was 2004 maybe when I was there. So it was early on. Yeah, I think we're both kind of learning, trying to figure out. And the funny thing about that whole story is that I had Justin Turner sitting to the right of me when he was at Cal State Fullerton. And Ken would talk me up and he'd say, hey, Justin, this guy played in pro ball, this and that. And Justin would just turn and go, hey, how is it? He'd ask me a couple of questions, but he was pretty serious himself.
So for people that don't know you, talk through your path. You have an intriguing path. So talk through your path for everybody.
Oh, yeah. Well, I played pro ball with the Dodgers. Late 90s, 96, 97, 98, 2001. I was there 5 years. I did well. I mean, I was a 300 hitter, so I kind of hit the mark on the average part. The only thing with me is that I was about 5'8", 5'9", 160. I just wasn't athletic enough, and I didn't have enough power at 165, 170. So it was one of those where I couldn't get that past that hump of like high single A. Even though I had great seasons, Another interesting thing was I was a high school dropout. So I don't know. It's I don't know how many people go from high school dropouts to doctorate, but I think that's a very interesting path. I always tell people I took the scenic route.
How did you get signed then? If you're a high school dropout, how'd you get signed?
I got real lucky. I went to a junior college. So when you have your GED, and I didn't even know this, so I was able to get my GED. And with a GED, apparently you could attend junior college. And once I got there, I ran into Coach Masmanian. So he was you're talking about like Sparky Anderson, those kind of like, you know, old school coaches. And he was probably close to his 70s when I went there. And Coach Maz just kind of took me under his wing, started telling me about like accountability, right? He didn't let me get away with anything. I remember the first game we ever had was at LA City College. And I went out the night before, obviously, you know, and it was one of those where I faked a flat tire. So Saturday at 9 in the morning, the game, I went out. I got home probably around 4 or 5 in the morning. Just couldn't get anything together in my life at that point. And I remember Coach Mass called me around 8:50 or something like that. And he's like, where you at? And I was like, I got a flat tire, Coach. Sorry, I'm not going to make it to the game. Da-da-da-da-da. And the bus was leaving at 9. And Coach Mass was like, I'll see you. He's like, you're my starting shortstop. I'm plugging you in the lineup right now. He's like, I'll see you at LA City College. Here's the address. Be there. I remember I drove, got out. As soon as I got out, I ran straight to shortstop, started playing. And it was one of those that, for me, it was a very big learning moment because to that point in my life, I was 18. Every coach I had let me get away with it. Every person in my life had let me get away with, I'm sorry, I can't make it. I'm sorry, I'm not going to go. With Coach Maz, there was no excuse of like, there's game, you're going to make it regardless.
When did the light bulb then start to go on for you from an accountability standpoint personally? Because I think about accountability a lot. We talk about it a lot. I think you really have to start to hold yourself accountable more than having others hold you accountable. When did that start to happen for you?
I think it started after I talked to the Dodger scout. You know, I think probably our second, third game of the season, the Dodger scout came up to me and said, hey, man, you got some talent. He said, I'll be around. I'm going to keep my eye on you. I really like the way you move. I like the way you play. I like the way you hit. And it was one of those where after meeting Ross Sapp, that's when I started to go like, hey, guess what? Like, if scouts are talking to me, maybe I should be a little bit more accountable. I also had a real good friend I had a friend that drove me for the entire year to class. And I think it's one of those where there was a point in my life where I just wasn't accountable to myself or my friends or anybody. And after a while, after probably about a good, I think it took me a whole year probably to really develop that accountability. Because when I came back my second year, I didn't have that friend there anymore. And I was like, you know what, at this point, I got to get it together. But I'll tell you this, Ryan, is for me, it was always a struggle of finding resources, having the resources, having people help me out, because I was always looking for excuses. But after probably about a solid year, then I started to realize, like, you know what, I think I could do this. I can go to class. But it wasn't probably really to a pro ball where I really became really accountable. And then I started to learn a lot about, all right, guess what, don't go out anymore. All right, this is a profession, you know, like they're going to send you home.
Out, isn't it? I mean, drugs, alcohol, and women are the quickest way out of professional baseball, correct?
Oh, 100%. I remember, we had a scary moment when I was first signed. You know, as we had some players that got in some trouble. Same thing, late night out, went out with girls, da 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 da. And we had like 9 players get released from the Mets. And it was just one of those for me where I was like, okay, this is for reals. This is you can't be getting in trouble because you're on the first flight home.
Yeah, one of my former college summer league teammates got signed by the Orioles and was not making good decisions. He's in the parking lot drinking beer and got released. He immediately got released by the Orioles.
Yeah, it's not a game anymore once you get to pro ball. So that's for me when it really turned around and I was like, you know what? I think at this point I got to be accountable to myself and then also to my family, right? Because I did get a good chunk of money when I signed. I was able to get my parents from the home where I grew up, like real low income, to more of a middle class home. So I moved my entire family out. I literally put down all my signing bonus to move my family into a better home. And at that point, I was like, you know what? This might be my shot to make sure that we don't go back to where we're at. So it was a lot of different things that clicked at that point. But at that point, I'm 19, 20, and I'm starting to kind of come into my own.
At 25, you get released. Was it hard for you to go back to school then, or were you like, okay, I've got to get a degree now?
Well, here's the thing is, at 25, I actually didn't get released. And I think that's one of the things that the story I always miss with my story is that part. Yeah. Is that at 25, I didn't get released. Is I almost released myself. You know, because at that point, I had played five seasons, hit 300, 340. They're talking about you're going to go to AA. I'm in spring training. And they just, a part of me was just not happy anymore. You know, at that point, I had just, I was become so much like, it turned into a business. And I just wasn't having fun on the field anymore. And I was like, you know what? I'm 25. I'm a high school dropout. And then I started looking at players that were in their 30s and they were getting released. And after looking at the looks in their faces and going like, what am I going to do with my life? I started thinking like, that might be me in 5 years. You know, if I stick around, it might be me at 30, 35, 36. AAA, still trying to climb myself up and down from the big leagues, whatever it is. And I was just thinking, like, I'm going to be a high school dropout. What then? Am I going to go? And I used to work at a warehouse. Like, they used to break down mail for the post office and load containers. And I was like, I'm probably going to end up loading containers at 35. And I got no respect in that warehouse. And I said, you know what? I'm 25. Could I commit to something right now where it's actually going to benefit me long term, like for the rest of my life? But my wife was very instrumental in that too, because she said, I mean, she would, whenever you have some one person that believes in you, sometimes a lot of things become possible that you thought were impossible. And I remember her telling me like, you know what, even if I have to do your homework, I'll do it. Like, it doesn't matter. I'll go to every class with you. I'll sit next to you. And the funny part about that whole story is like a year later, she was actually asking me a bunch of questions about how to do things.
So how'd you pick Fullerton then?
Fullerton for me was they had a degree in kinesiology that I was very interested in. So it was just an easy transition into because I went to Chaffey College. I went to a junior college and I did my general ed. And then I felt like Fullerton was a good school. It was also a commuter school because I was living with my parents. So I was going to Fullerton, working at the same warehouse I left baseball with. I was still working there trying to make ends meet. And then I was just kind of going like, all right, Fullerton seems like a good mix. And then after that, that's when I found Ken Revisa and I found the Fullerton crew, man.
And then what drove you then to get your doctorate?
Oh, that's another interesting story is when I first got to Fullerton, my biggest thing was becoming like a P teacher coach. And then I started to realize like, hey, coaching is hard, right? Coaching is not what people think coaching is like, oh, you're just going to go to the field. You're just going to kind of like la, 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 la. No, I started to realize like, hey, you know what? It's a full-time job. So I said, is it really in me to be a coach? Like 100% be a coach, baseball coach. Do I really, you know, and at that point, I mean, I don't know if I was still jaded, right? I mean, I just got off being a pro player, pulling all my life into it and still kind of, I mean, at that point, I think I was still trying to figure out my love for baseball. Did I love baseball or was it something that I was just good at? You know, it was just like, I was an in-betweener, you know, where I was like, I don't know. So then I realized, like, you know what? I probably don't want to go that route. Another thing was there wasn't many job opportunities. So I felt like, you know what? I'm just going to go into something where I'm kind of behind already. I was 28, 29, just thinking like, okay, what else can I do? And then I talked to one of my counselors and she said, physical therapy is like right down the road for you. So you might want to think about that, which was challenging though, because I was taking courses to be a P teacher, which is not, they're not as hard as being a physical therapist. I started and had done a lot of the harder courses, but at that point, I just kind of said, well, I got to shoot for the stars. And if I miss, then hopefully I'll land somewhere good anyways.
Did you have to do a dissertation for your PT doctorate?
Yeah, we had to do one. That was an interesting project.
Yeah, what was your project?
We did it on ankle dorsiflexion, okay. Which was interesting, right? We did it on static stretching right now is like one of the biggest things. Should you do it, not do it, right? And we did an ankle dorsiflexion. Okay, if you do a calf stretch, does it really change your gait mechanics? And it did. You know, it kind of changed it. It increased the range of motion. But what I've learned since then is that almost like increasing range of motion is also, it's not the holy grail that people think, you know?
Yeah, it depends on the athlete, correct?
100%.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a fascinating thing for me is we're just diving into all of that here in the last 10 years where it's going to be amazing to see where we go. You know, for you personally, What weren't you getting professional baseball that maybe now you're giving to athletes that you didn't get as a player?
Well, for me, it was movement training. I think it's one of those where, man, back in the 90s, early 2000s, like, we were really not talking about, like, movement was one of those where we either thought you had it or you didn't have it, right? Either you're a natural, and then most of us were. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I didn't have a hitting instructor. How do I get signed without having a hitting instructor or no one ever tell me how to hit? My dad takes credit, but all my dad did was just put it on the tee for me. He takes credit for my hitting, but all he did was pitch to me and put it on the tee, you know?
Sometimes that's all it takes with the better ones, though, just the reps.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, when you have a talent and you have a knack for it, and that's just your hand-eye coordination is next level, your vision is next level, then I think you can get away with it. But I think for me, it's just I didn't have that extra, like, all right, how do you move? How do you move better? So what happened with me was once the season went on and started dragging on, I would feel tight and tighter and tighter and tighter. And then my movements would become very restricted and constrained. And I felt like that's something that we didn't get back then. And that's kind of what drove me to start the baseball flows. It was like, okay, what gap do I still see that I had back in the 90s? And another thing was when I got into PT, a lot of people don't know this, but like in 2010, 2011, somewhere around there, in PT, we had this huge battle between manual therapists and movement science, right? Because there was a lot of guys like in the 1990s to early 2000s that did a lot of manual work. So they did massage, they did joint manipulation, they started to joint mobilizations. And they worked a lot on just single joints. And they felt like, okay, if we do that, then athletes are able to get better. They're able to do everything they need to do not to get injured. And then we had the whole movement science that was looking at movement, the hip hinge. They were looking at scapular stabilization. They were looking at scapular humeral rhythm. And it was this battle between, like, well, who are you going to be in 2010 when I graduated? Are you going to be movement or are you going to be manual? You know, and for me, I went through a residency with Kaiser, and that kind of helped me figure out, you know what, the movement seems to be the biggest game changer for athletes.
Is the coaching cue move better similar to the coaching cue of throw strikes?
Kind of. Yeah, I'll tell you, yeah, I think it's the same thing where you know, it's just, yeah, just throw strikes, yeah, just move better. It's like, yeah, of course, man, who doesn't want to do that?
So you get on that track of movement. I mean, when did you really start to piece together just everything with the flow movements? Because I do really like what you have and what you're having athletes do. I do really like that part of it. But when did it really go off to like, okay, this is probably what's best for athletes?
Well, it evolved. You know, it evolved because I was a very standard, and I use the word standard PT just because, I mean, everybody kind of understands what PTs do, right? We kind of deal with injuries. We do a lot of rehab exercises. We do low-level exercises, high-level exercises. But for me, it was always about when you go into physical therapy, you also have to somewhat choose, are you going to be an orthopedic physical therapist or a neurophysical therapist? And there's not much overlap between both of them. One of them works on mechanical structure, stretching, all that stuff that you see, coordination. The other one works on strokes, more neurological issues. But I found that, like, hey, guess what? Maybe we could use a lot of what these guys are doing in the neurological world and bring it into the orthopedic world. And that's when I found the developmental kinesiology was a big, big just bridge between those two. And also what players were missing. You know, where a lot of players that I was treating at that point, 12, 13, 11-year-olds that were getting injured, they couldn't do a lot of the flows that I teach now and definitely couldn't go through the movement screening we've developed.
When did you decide to do the website?
Probably two years ago, maybe.
So you just started it.
Oh yeah, no. This
who nudged you to say, hey, this needs to get on the web?
I'll be honest with you. It was one of those where I started looking at them in my house first. So I started just, hey, guess what? I got three little ones. So I try to figure out, okay, with my three little ones, let me look at these developmental patterns and let me see what's going on here with DNS, with all these developmental patterns, and kind of figure out, is this really a thing that players that makes sense for the baseball field? As I started doing that, eventually my wife was like, what are you doing? Like, why do you keep like recording our kids? Why do you keep rolling on the ground with them? What's going on here? And I said, hey, I'm developing a system. I'm going to develop a system for baseball players. And she's like, okay, whatever. And then one day, she was down there with me when I was recording. I was talking to another coach, And I was recording myself doing the movements. And my wife says, hey, that looks really cool. Whatever it is you're doing there, she's like, you should go and develop a website and just start, you know, get on Twitter, get on social media. He's like, because I've never seen anything like that. And my wife's a school psychologist by trade. So she's not a movement person. It's not like she's a PT and she gets it like, oh, okay, I understand movement. She just realized like whatever you're doing there looks exactly what they're doing on the field. And if you can start teaching some of those deeper movements, the impact that I was going to have. So she kind of nudged me into it. Now, when I first started, I mean, that was probably the biggest gap too, is I didn't understand technology that well. I mean, I didn't understand the website. I definitely did not understand an app, a phone app, how to develop it. And if I did, it was kind of like the old school, it's going to take you $100,000 to develop an app type deal. So it was one of those where it's evolved a lot since then, but we didn't really go live probably till like September 2022, 2021, somewhere around there.
Are any things that you believe now that you believed back then that you don't believe in now?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those where I thought the first, like just working on real simple transitions was going to transfer to hitting, to pitching. And then I started to realize like, hey, you know what? That I was getting players just too low level movements. You know, they weren't as dynamic as they are in the baseball field. So it's just one of those that I used to believe, oh, as long as you can master this little transition from lying on your back to the side plank and just back and forth, eventually skill wise, you're going to do well. Now it's just one of those where I go like, no, I think we need to work on the entire flow. We need to work on the entire global movement pattern. And then from there, then we can start chopping it up if we have to into segments, really working on single transitions and things like that. But before I thought a lot about more mechanical, you know, the mechanical component of it. Now I think the neurological component of it is just, if you can do that, you get there quicker, faster, and it just kind of sticks around. The movement patterns are just, they're more robust when you work through that avenue.
Do you feel like there's some neural pathway piece to this? Because it is challenging. It's got to be challenging in the beginning. And then as they work through it, it gets easier. Do you feel like there's some neural pathway positives to this?
I think 100%. I think that's exactly what we're shooting for with the app, is we're trying to get into those ingrained neural pathways that you had that are in you. Like we're not really trying to create new ones, right? It's we're trying to ingrain the ones that are already in you, whatever natural patterns you have. Because what happens a lot with players is they stop exploring. I mean, in general, right? I mean, I think it's one of those where as human beings, we're meant to move. We're meant to explore. We're meant to do challenging movements. And we're meant to solve those problems. And we're meant to develop robust solutions for them. And I think at a certain point, I don't know if it was like the 2020, all those shutdowns, everything that happened. But I just started to see different patterns in our clinics and just going like, hey, well, hold on. Like these kids are coming in with patterns that we hadn't really seen before.
It almost has a Turkish get-up feel to it on some of the exercises.
Oh, 100%. I think the Turkish getup, the only thing with the Turkish getup is that it's just not a natural pattern. But the components of like, hey, guess what?
Challenging, though. It's a challenging exercise.
Challenging, the verticality of it, right? I mean, people don't understand about like the way we learn movement. It's fairly simple, right? Is you need vertical changes. You need east to west changes. You need to solve problems in those spaces. And you just need to do it through natural patterns. And it's one of those that if you can do that, then that plays on the baseball field 100%. Because in baseball, you function in small spaces. And if you're able to transition and get those transitions and speed up those movements, you're going to be dangerous when it comes to ground balls, when it comes to hitting, pitching.
Is this something you can do every day?
Yeah, it's natural. So I always tell people it's almost like a joke where you go like, you could climb a tree every day, right? So it's one of those where you go like,
but me as a 49, I would have to work into, I'd have to work into it as a 49 year old. I think I would have to do a warm up before the flow warm up.
I think everybody should do a little bit of I always tell people like sprint, run something before you start going, because you do want to wake up those neural pathways. You do want to be robust when you're moving. You don't want to be working through constraints when you're doing the flows. And I don't know if you've tried any of the movements, but they're challenging.
Challenging.
Yeah.
So how many pro guys are you working with now with this?
I kind of lost count, to be honest with you.
Love it.
Yeah. I mean, I used to count them. I used to go like, oh my God, we got 3 pro guys. We got 4 pro guys. Now, I'll be honest with you, I don't know how many, because some of them will just sign on and they like to be left alone and they do their own thing, right? Some of them do reach out and they kind of want more. They want to go through the movement screen. So we have 6 movements that we can put people through movement screens. I don't force it on anybody. The app only does one, because I feel like with one, we're able to get a real good picture of how you move. And then we are able to track it over months. But the pro guys, some of them will reach out. We do all 6. The funny thing is, I just had a guy.
Be honest with pro guys, is sometimes they don't want their org to know that they're doing it.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I think that's true, right? But I think it's one of those where.
Nothing against you, but I know organizations, like, sometimes when players try to go out on their own a little bit, the orgs aren't happy with that, even though your stuff is great and it works. Like, that's the thing. I'm sure in the back of their mind, some orgs are like, I'm not letting them know I'm doing this.
Yeah, yeah, and I respect that, right? I mean, for me, I've always felt like whoever wants to come with me, the resources are there. If you want to, however you want to use them, however you want to implement them, I mean, I'm not one of those that says, hey, guess what? You only do it this way, and there's only one way to do it, and there's only one way to implement. I believe that if you're exploring and you're moving and you're going through these patterns, that there's many ways to get to your success, not just, hey, guess what? Everything is A, B, C, and D. So for me, I always think it's cool, though, because sometimes I'll see guys that are on the app, and my wife will tell me, and then I go, okay, and then I'll see them make a play, like on ESPN or something, and I'm like, oh, there, yeah, he's got the pattern's working, man.
What is the one movement assessment you have on the app?
We have, like, the walk up from the ground. So you're lying on your back, and then you end up, like, in this, like, running man position, standing up on a single leg, and then you go right back on your back. So it's almost like I think they might call it, like, the Romanian getup or something like that, but I probably just butchered that, to be honest with you. I haven't looked into
That's
it, but for me.
It's a longevity test, too. So they say once people can't do that anymore from a seated position, get standing up, like it's almost the beginning of the end for people, like older people, because they have a hard time doing that.
Well, the 30 seconds sit to stand, right? The 30 seconds sit to stand. I mean, there's great studies on if you're a certain age, you can't do 12 of them, you can't do 17. I'll tell you this, Ryan, I think that's the biggest thing I've also noticed in the clinics is the ability to get up from the ground. You should never lose that. And I mean, and that's one of those where I see people in their 60s and 70s that are coming in saying, hey, guess what? I won't be able to do that anymore. And I go like, okay, then they're wearing the little necklace, right? Because they can't do it anymore. And I've seen them actually even get better. Go like, okay, this is how we're going to work on the transitions. And for me, that's very key, because when you work with a population that's limited, it helps you work with a population that has other limitations. Might not be as great as this population, but at the same time, there's a lot of carryover on the skill acquisition part of it. And for me, it's crucial to work with patients and people from different populations, because then I start to learn. It forces me to get into like the really greedy part of like, all right, what is physical therapy? How do we get people better? And some of just that old school principles.
That was the thing when I taught yoga, because anybody could come in and take my class, and I had 80-year-olds and I had college athletes in that class. So I had to figure out how to modify movements for people, which was great for me. And it helped me actually coach better on the field, because I was having to modify things for people. With your own kids, do you feel like their confidence level picked up as they're moving through all the training?
Yeah, I think that was a big one. You know, there's a couple of things that have come from the movements that I didn't expect, you know? So it's one of those where, I remember my first couple of clients, they would send me thank you notes. And a lot of the thank you notes were not like, hey, my kid's hitting 300, my kid's exit velo. A lot of the thank you notes were like, hey, my son used to, like, he had trouble sleeping. Now when he does your movements, he sleeps through the night. Or my son was having trouble getting bullied, you know, and his self-confidence now is through the roof because he moves better. Oh, my son didn't participate in recess, so now he's out there and the teacher's telling me that he's trying different stuff. And he's actually participating and running and doing things, right? And I think people don't understand how much movement plays into the psychology of a kid. I mean, think about it. If you don't move well, you're not going to explore. If you don't move well, you're not going to want to go on the playground, be with your friends. If you don't move well, you're always going to be that shy kid that doesn't really speak up. Everything is connected, you know?
How are you blending kind of the science piece of it with the feel piece of it?
What do you mean?
I mean, there's research on all of this stuff, but for you, adjusting flow, I mean, it's probably ever evolving here with what you're adding, correct?
100%. And I think that's the hard part, is the science, it's almost a little bit behind from what I see, right? It's when I looked, because when I first started this, I wanted to be 100%, let me go look at the research. What has been researched? I want to make sure that I stay with, that's how I was trained. Everything is evidence-based. Everything is research-based. You know, there's got to be a study. There's got to be a peer review. And then I started to notice, like, okay, hold on. There is no peer review study. There is no one has tried this before. I went to my alma mater. I went to Loma Linda, and I said, hey, guess what? I want to do a study where I put an entire high school on my flows program. They could go through it in and out. I'm trying to figure it out. And then at the end, they're like, oh, that's kind of a big study. You know, we do more of A, B, C, and D. And there's a lot of constraint. People don't understand sometimes about research is there's a lot of constraints to research. There's a lot of like, hey, guess what? You got to have a control group. You got to have this, you got to have that. At the end of the day, once you get a research project, it's almost as simple as like what I did in my dissertation, which was ankle dorsiflexion. That's the only thing we could actually really measure, find it to be valuable, find it to be valid, find it. I mean, you start to stack all these things onto what needs takes into a research. And then you lose the essence of a movement where you go like, okay, how are we going to measure movement flow? How are we going to measure it? And what's a valid tool to measure movement flow? Is it your movement screen? Is it the six movements that you come up with? And has those been verified scientifically? I mean, it's one of those where after a while you just go like, okay, well, guess what? Evidence-based is not just about research, though. Evidence-based does bring in clinical experience. So I said, well, guess what? How about if I take the research principles that are there, and how about if I start looking at it from my clinical experience, other PTs, because I have other PTs that I work with. I mean, I worked in a clinic with 30 PTs. So when I developed the movements and I developed the program, I had a plethora of PTs from, I mean, therapists that were working with ALS, therapists that were working with strokes, therapists that were working with, rotator cuff. I mean, you name it. We had every type of therapist there. Pediatrics, right? We had therapists that were working with peds. And it was one of those that I ran my program through that experience also to figure out, hey, does this make sense? Does the research and what I'm doing make sense? And then I knew the baseball part. I mean, I knew the baseball part left and right. I already knew, like, hey, guess what? If I do this and players work through these flows, when they swing, this is what the changes that they're going to have. When they throw, because for me, all I did was I did the flows and then I went hitting. And I started to realize, oh, my God. Like I feel so much more fluidity. I feel my contact point. I feel like I can manipulate my body. I feel like I can control it, especially for those pitches that I always struggled with, which is low and outside and up and in. Go, can I keep that up and in fastball fair? And I started to realize like, oh man, these movements transfer 100% to the baseball field. So that for me, that was easy. It was just getting that foundational of the research, the foundation of clinical experience, and then marrying it with like, hey, guess what? This works for baseball, softball, no doubt.
Well, because as a research, and I did research too, because you know it works, it's almost like, why would you even have a control group? Because you'd want everybody to do it. Like, why would
exactly.
you have a control group that doesn't do it? Like, that's one of those things. It's like, okay, that's where the science kind of gets in the way on some of this stuff. And I understand with research, but this is like, okay, this helps everybody. Why would we want to have a group that's actually not doing it?
And I think that's hard, right? Because you are playing with people's career, right? You're going like, hey, guess what? These 10 players are going to get it. These other 10s are going to get something else. And you're going like, hey, guess what? You're right. Why don't we just do it with all of them? Because at a certain point, the player's well-being and the player's career supersedes anything that, for me as a clinician, I'm trying to accomplish.
You know, with the ego piece and, with ego-driven people, sometimes they don't want to look like they don't know what's going on. How are you kind of coaching them through that? Hey, these movements may not look great in the beginning when you start doing them.
Well, I think at the beginning, we got a lot of people that were real open to it, right? I think that's like with anything, you get like the early adopters who really didn't question it, right? They kind of just understood like, hey, I get it. These are the neural pathways that we develop. These are the developmental patterns. These patterns we use all the time. We hit with these patterns. If we clean those up, if we cleaned up the foundation. So they understood it. They didn't even question it. You know, I think once we hit that second tier now, because that's where we're at now as a company, is we're starting to hit that second tier where we're getting a lot more questions, right? We're getting a lot more questions. We're getting a lot more like, hey, guess what? Why is this better than that? Or why are we not doing this, doing this? And I think for me, it's one of those where I learn a lot from those questions because everybody has a blind spot. Everybody, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, when you develop a system, it's never perfect. It's always one of those where you go like, we're evolving. I'm listening to people. I'm going like, yeah, you bring up a great point. Maybe I should look into that. Maybe I missed that, you know? Another cool thing has been that a lot of teams, like that other day, someone sent me a flow and they said, hey, check out this movement, Doc. And I just thought to myself, I was like, yeah, one of the kids had already sent it to. It was funny because that same week, another kid had sent me a play that he made. So I sent it back to that coach and said, hey, coach, look what this kid sent me. Same identical movement. And I was just thinking to myself, like, this is crazy. What we started 6-7 years ago, exploring the evolution of it, where now I'm having discussions with coaches about like, hey, look at the plays that the players that are on our app are making. And look at what you just developed, right? So I think it's, I don't know. I just love the baseball community. I think egos are going to play into it. But for me,
I'm seeing less and less of it, though. And I've been around this industry my whole life since I was 5. I'm seeing less and less of the egos, which is a great thing. And honestly, the questions are better. It's almost like you're coaching the newer generation of kids. They're going to have a lot more questions because it forces you to clarify what you're doing. Like the questions that you get have to help you because it's forcing you to clarify what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, every time I talk to coaches, I'm just going, hey, you got any more questions? Any more questions? Because if you have a question, most people are going to have the same question. And for me, it's hard to implement a system when people have questions, right? When people still have questions about why are we doing this? How does this transfer? How are we implementing it? So for us, when we work with teams, I always tell people is like, it's almost like you hired a movement coach. Like you almost hired your own therapist because I don't just give you, okay, guess what? Get on the app and then good luck trying to figure it out. I'm side by side with the coach trying to figure out how we're going to implement. Okay, how are the players responding to it? Do they have any questions? Are they still kind of doubtful of how they're doing it? Because any system without implementation is pointless.
And you mentioned earlier from a stretching standpoint, from hypermobile athletes, are there ones that maybe shouldn't do it because their hips are too mobile? Is there such a thing as too mobile in the hips for baseball players? I don't know if that's a thing, but I know the general population maybe, but I haven't probably seen it in the hip region where athletes are too mobile in their hips.
Well, here's the cool thing about the system, right, is that for us, it's always been more about coordination, stabilization. And we found that everybody needs stabilization, right? The stiff guy is stiff because he's not stabilizing somewhere in the line, somewhere in that movement chain, he's not stabilizing. So if you're not stabilizing, you're going to get stiff somewhere. The loose guys, they all need stability, 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 stability. Now, what's cool about it is that your body will self-organize into whatever it is you need. But once your global patterns are clean, then the guys that need the hypermobile player, right, that's just loose all over the place, they're going to get very stable chain movements. The ones that are tight are going to start to stabilize, and then they'll start to loosen up where they were stiff. So through global movement patterns, we're able to gain mobility, coordination. We're able to kind of get everything all at once in a system. So it's one of those where I'll be honest with you, I think most baseball players that play at a high level are hypermobile in general. Right? I think if you're a stiff one.
I think it's a barrier of entry. If you're stiff, I don't think you get that opportunity to play at the next level.
No, I'll tell you this.
Scouts aren't going to draft that.
Well, right. I'll be honest with you. I thought I was stiff my whole life. I always felt stiff and I was like, I'm stiff. And then I started comparing myself with my coworkers and I started moving and I was like, oh yeah, this is not stiff. I was like, I don't think. And then I started looking at my back and my spine and my rotation and my coworkers are just looking at me like, yeah, you're definitely.
You were around athletes your whole time. Like that's a thing. You're comparing yourself to other people that can do that as opposed to the general population. And I do like the coordination piece for me, I think is great because it's both sides. You're using both hemispheres of your brain because of that. I just think there's a lot of positives from a coordination standpoint, big piece of that.
Yeah, and PT, that was my biggest thing that I learned from the movement science part, is we have this teacher, Shirley Sowerman. I don't know if you've heard of her.
I haven't.
But I believe she's out of St. Louis. she's very instrumental in PT because she started looking at movement back in like the early 2000s, late 90s. And it's one of those where she wrote a book on it. And Shirley, when I would go to her seminar, she would always work on the coordination part. She would never work on, oh, you're stiff. Let me manipulate your joint. Let me work on the manual component. You know, she always felt that through coordination, you can conquer any movement problem or any movement issue that somebody's having. And for me, with the flows, that's exactly what the approach that I took. Through global movement patterns, we're going to clean up the entire movement. And if you're a stiff one, you're going to loosen up. If you're a loose one, you're going to tighten up. And it's one of those that with coordination, that's been the missing link that a lot of people don't work on, is everything needs to be coordinated in a pattern.
Do you have a fail forward moment dropping out of high school? Is that your fail forward moment, or do you have other fail forward moments? Something looking back now, something you thought was going to set you back, but it helped you move forward?
I think probably dropping out of high school, and then also the leaving baseball. I mean, at 25, I think it was one of those where I just felt like, all right, this could be one of those too, where you go from, I mean, people don't understand too, is when you play professional baseball, everywhere you go, everybody wants to talk to you. It didn't matter. You know, my dad's friends all of a sudden were my best friends. I mean, everywhere I went, I mean, I used to go to my dad's because I played Sunday league with my dad when I was a dropout. And I used to go to the games when I was pro. And everybody would just come up to me and go like, oh, my God, can you talk to my son? Can you da-da-da-da-da? I would give him equipment. I would things that I would get from the Dodgers. I would come back, give him baseball bats. But it was one of those that everybody, you're almost a little bit of a like a city hero, right? Of your city, of the people around you. And I went from that to all of a sudden, once you leave, like they stop coming, and it happens fairly quick. People don't realize it. It literally happened.
My dad said it a lot. It's one of his, he had a lot of good quotes, but my favorite one is, you see the same people on the way up as you do on the way down. Like, that's my favorite quote. And it reminds you to be humble, because, you know, you're going to have low points and then you're going to have high points, but you also figure out pretty quick, like, who's actually in your corner and who's not. When things start to not go your way, you figure out pretty quick who's in your corner and who's not.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, the funny thing was, I love that you say that, because the friend that drove me for that year to Mount SAC, to that junior college, is, I just talked to him last week, right? And he has stuck around from, you're a dropout, I'm going to drive you, to, hey, you have a doctorate now, you're doing baseball flows. And all I talked about was, he wanted to get his kid on the app. So I got his kid on our app, and I'm just thinking to myself, man, we came full circle. He drove me to, as a high school dropout, and then now I'm working with him with my doctorate, with everything that I've developed. And it's funny because he reads my newsletters. I didn't even know he did. And he's like, man, I love your newsletters, man. He's like, I can't even do half of the flows, but I'm going to get my son on it and this and that. I was just thinking to myself, you know what? You're right. The people, the same people will stick around when you didn't have anything. And then obviously my wife was instrumental in that one too.
Now, are you doing the movement flows personally yourself?
Well, I'll tell you this. When I was developing, I was doing them daily. So I'm trying to figure it out. And then there comes a point where you go from development to implementation as a company. And then you start to go like, okay, I got to start reading books. I got to start doing A, B, C, and D. So I literally last 2 months, I forced myself back on the app. So I said, all right, I'm going to develop a program and I'm going to do it 4 times a week. Because I started to realize, like, my golf game started to suffer. I went from, like, I used to shoot 100. I did the baseball flows. Then I went down to, like, 85. And then now I started to go, like, I went and played, and I shot, like, 96. And I was like, hey, hold on. I think I'm starting to lose my flow. So I'm back on it.
What other morning or evening routines do you do that you like?
Running. I think running is a good one. You know, running, it for me, has always been a – it's a natural pattern, so I feel like it gets everything back to where it's functioning well and moving well.
When do you run? You run in the mornings, you run later?
I got 3 boys. I run whenever they let me, you know? sometimes even run away from them.
Oh, goodness. So for anybody else that's trying to look into this stuff, besides your website, what other resources should they dive into?
Well, I think the website covers everything. Because we have everything on the website. We have the coaches.
And
we have a level one.
Baseballflows.com. I'm looking at it. For anybody that hasn't been on Dr. Gallo's website, it's baseballflows.com.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the website has the coaches certification. It has all the programs that we have on there to sign up, where people could contact us, where they could sign up for the newsletter. It's got some of my previous podcast episodes, if people want to listen a little bit more about the science behind it.
What are some final thoughts before I let you go, or something else I should have asked you? Because if I let something fall through the cracks here, let's talk about it.
We covered a lot. I'll be honest with you. This was probably one of the podcasts where I covered a lot of it. But I think for me, I always like to make sure that I had a final thought of like belief, right? I mean, one of the things that I've learned through my whole process of from high school dropout to minor leagues to back to school into the doctorate, into the baseball flows, is that if you don't believe in yourself, like there's really, you don't get much in life, right? And it's one of those that sometimes you almost have to rely on that belief more than on anything that's going on externally. Because, you know, I think there was a lot of times, even with building the baseball flows, where I felt like, oh, this is harder than I thought, right? There's a lot of points where you could quit on it. You could kind of go back and say, oh, man, maybe I should just, because I still have a career, right? So I could always just go back to, oh, maybe I should just be a physical therapist. Maybe that's my career. Maybe I just go that route. But I felt like the belief also that I had in my system to say, guess what? I've developed something that is very unique and innovative. And I developed something that could help a lot of players from ages 8 all the way to pros. And I said, I got to believe in myself and I got to believe in my system to just keep going and just keep putting it out, right? Because it's one of those where without that belief, I think that's one thing that I was missing when I dropped out of school, is I had zero belief in myself and I had zero belief that I could figure it out or that I had anything to offer to the world or the community.
Did anybody try to talk you out of dropping out of high school?
No, I think it's one of those, I've always been somewhat of a loner, not a loner, but like a loner thinker. Right. And I mean, I got four brothers, two sisters. So I'm the youngest of, I'm pretty sure down that road, one of them had a talk with me. But for me, it was always one of those where I just thought, all right, like this is kind of my destiny, right? My destiny is school's not for me. I'm not very good at it. I don't understand what they're saying. I don't get it. One thing I just didn't realize was that all I had to do was show up.
You did get it. I mean, look at what you've done. Like you didn't realize at the time, but you did actually get it. There's like a David Goggins feel to your story. Like I love David Goggins. So there's a lot of David Goggins feel to your story about no matter what life is handing you, like you pulled yourself up off the mat and you did that for yourself. Like nobody can do that for you. You did that for yourself.
Yeah, there's definitely an underdog. There's definitely some type of like, hey, guess what? I've been at the lowest of lows, right? Education-wise, I mean, people don't understand how it feels to show up to class after missing, though. I probably missed that whole week and literally go like, all right, now you're no longer welcome here, right? Like, you're no longer welcome at a public school. Now you got to try to find other means to get your education. I never thought it would get to that point, but it did. But like you mentioned, I think it's one of those where I failed big. But then at the same time, when I got my second opportunity at Mount SAC, it just brought me back to like, hey, that won't happen to me again. And I got to develop this belief somehow. And for me, it was also good people around me at the time that were able to really just help me through some of the struggles that I had.
When did the light bulb go on at Mount SAC where it's like, okay, maybe I'm a little better in the classroom than what I thought originally?
The coach told me, interesting enough, Coach Matt said.
God bless coaches.
I'll tell you this, Coach Matt said, he called me over to the side and said, hey, I talked to your instructor. And every time somebody said that for me in the past, I was like, oh, here it comes. Like, what did I do now, right? And he said, they tell me you're brilliant, that all you need to do is show up. And when he told me that, I mean, I was 19, and I just didn't think much of it. I was like, all right, whatever, coach. Like, what am I going to do, right? Like, I guess I'll just show up. Now, after I got my doctorate, after I did all that stuff, I was like, you know what? Those instructors must have seen something that I didn't even see myself when I was 19 or 20. And obviously, Coach Mass saw something in me to pull me to the side and say, hey, guess what? I've been talking to people, and they've actually told me that you got a brain in you, that you're doing really well, da 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 da, that you're understanding a lot, like higher concepts that a lot of people don't understand.
It's called the Pygmalion effect. I talk about it a lot when I go on the circuit, and they did studies at Stanford with teachers. It was a fake study where they basically told these teachers that these five students in their class were the most gifted, even though it was a BS like assessment. So they weren't really, or some were, but it had more to do with the teacher's perception of the students than it actually had to do with the aptitude of the students, which is something great for teachers and coaches to hear, because how you perceive your students or your players, that maybe has more to do with where they're going to end up or how they end up more than anything that they have inside of them. So like that's a huge deal that you had good people around you that even though you didn't see it, they believed in you. And I think that's sometimes that's all people need to hear sometimes, is that person believes in me.
And I think, I think you're right. I mean, there's definitely a positive to it. Now that you mentioned that, I think there's also the negative component of it too, right? Because I felt like when I was in high school, I got the opposite effect.
Yes. Yep.
I got the opposite effect of as soon as I walked in the classroom, they thought this guy's trouble.
Yes.
And as soon as I started trouble, I remember in eighth grade, I must have got kicked out of my math class every single day. Go outside. Every time I would say something, go stand outside. Go stand outside. Like, you're disruptive. Get out of here. Yep. And I remember it was almost like a joke where I was like, all right, how quickly am I going to get kicked out of this classroom?
Yep.
And I would say something smart and the teacher would just go, all right, go outside for 15 minutes. And at that point, I felt like I was almost getting the opposite effect of that, of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it works that, better. Because like you might say, hey, the assessment came back and these are your five worst students. And so they're going to treat them differently too. And like, it's an amazing thing with how that works. That environment piece has a lot to do with it. That's why I try to tell coaches that every year, treat your players like they're championship players, because what they did in the past, that doesn't mean they're going to act that way in the future if you treat them differently.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what happened with me. It was when I got to Mount SAC, it was coach said, he said, "It's I don't care what you did in high school. I don't care if you're all city. I don't care what you did. When we come here, the best nine are going to play." And once I heard that, I remember it clicked in my head where I was like, oh, the best nine are going to play. All right, so I got a chance, right? Because I didn't do anything in high school. So I'm actually on the other end, right, where guys were saying like, oh, this guy hit 500 in high school. He hit X amount of home runs. And he's at shortstop. And I'm going like, how am I going to beat this guy up? You know, and it's one of those where once he said that, I said, hey, guess what? There's a chance. Because at that point, I did have belief that I could play baseball because I was always good on every team. And I just felt like, oh, you know what? Let me give it my best shot. And amazingly enough, that other kid ended up redshirting, and then I started over him.
The universe took care of you. The universe took care of you. All right, sir, thank you so much for your time. It's awesome that we finally got connected. So this was awesome for me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
I love being introduced to new people in the baseball community. We have a great group of people trying to push the envelope in training for players. Big reason why you're seeing the jumps in athleticism in the game right now. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Jim Richardson, Zach Hale, Matt West, and Antonio Walker in the ABCA office for all the help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at CoachB_ABCA, or direct message me via the My ABCA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you.